This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
By the additional things which are loaded on in the Pasuk, to go in his ways and to love him, everything that will come. The Gemara must be learning it. God asking of you, nothing but Yerushalayim. Why Yerushalayim? Why is that all he's asking from you? After all, the whole Torah. That explains Moshe, because Yerushalayim will bring you the lechus b'chol berachah, will bring you to gain his ways. Ulaavo Yisrael, that will bring you to love him. Ulaavo Yisrael Hashem l'kecha b'chol berachah b'chol nafshecha. You to serve him. One after the other. All that you have to do. And therefore ask the Gemara, and do not self, is that so simple? Is that so easy to fear God? Is that such a simple matter? Several months ago we had a series of shiurim. It might have even been a year ago on the Sedra, I'm not altogether clear. On Yerushalayim. And where we discussed Yiro at its very most basic level, at its primitive level of fear. Plain and simple fear. And we showed how that started all off. We based it, if you remember, on the bits of the Petterburg at the beginning of Shari Oil, where he goes through tracing the emotional steps to higher levels of Yiddishkeit from stage one. And stage one was plain and simple fear. Primitive, simple, being scared. And yet, in this pasuk, that doesn't seem to be altogether adequate. That we're talking here only of the fear of punishment, of the fear of consequence, that very primitive emotion of pachad. It doesn't seem that that's what we're talking about. The Mechaber Halavos in the beginning of Perek Vav of Shari Yichud HaMaaseh brings this pasuk. And he says, "V'ha'yiro inlo elo belev v'harayin v'hamachshova." What is the seat of yiro? Yiro, you will only find belev, and we discussed lev doesn't mean the emotions. And Chazal talked about lev, about the heart; they talked about the intellect. You'll only find yiro in the mind, v'harayin in thinking, v'hamachshova in the intellect. That's where you'll find yiro. And he says that on our very possible. This is not the simple primitive fear. This is already a sophisticated form of yira, whatever it means, and we'll try and understand it and define it a little bit more this evening. But it's a higher level of yira, which begins to be of great interest, because what has worried me, on the basis of those previous shiurim that we had, is if yira is so primitive that even animals have it. That's what we base that on. It's so simple, so basic. Not even human. Even an animal has fear. And if from that everything else flows, why doesn't anybody behave themselves? Why do we have such a tough time? If it really is Milka's Lutrasa, if it really is a simple matter, all you have to do is be scared, and that's a natural intuition which the emotion implanted in every living being. What's the difficulty? And here we see a hint in Rabbeinu Bechaya that this Yerushalayim which leads to everything else, it's not just the primitive fear of consequence, the fear of punishment. So what will we say? That this is the great yira, right? At the beginning of Hilchos Yisrael HaTorah of the Rambam, there's a perush on the side, an old perush, we don't know who it is. It's probably a rishon, a very early offering. And he explains there that there are two forms of yira, as we know. Yiras ha'inesh and yiras ha'ronus. Fear of punishment and the awe of God's greatness. So one would translate the one as fear and the one as awe. A-W-U. So what would we say then? That what Rabbeinu Bechaya is telling us is that this yira, which sets everything else off, is not the fear of punishment alone. This is already awe. This is holding the Ribbono Shel Olam in high esteem. That also can't be, because in last week's Sedra we had another pasuk in Perek Vav. Vayitzavenu Hashem la'asos es kol hachukim ho'ile, And Hashem is Baruch has commanded us to do all these statutes. Why? Le'yiro es Hashem Elokeinu, so that we will ultimately reach Yiro. That's talking about the greater Yiro. That's talking about Yiras HaLevus. So on the one hand, we have a pasuk last week that says you do all the mitzvahs in order that you can ultimately come to Yiro. And here we have a pasuk that says you must fear the Ribbono Shel Olam, you must have Yiro, for through Yiro you will do all the mitzvahs. Which comes first? What is it? So the Perush there says these are the two different Yiros. The Yiro in last week's sefer is talking about the fear of all holding the Ribbono Shel Olam in great esteem. This week we're talking about the lower levels of Yiro, the initial levels of Yiro, which is fear of consequence. That means that within that first level of Yiro, fear of consequence, there are also two levels. There's the primitive fear, which we discussed last time when we analyzed it, and there's the concept that Rabbeinu Bechaya is referring to, this intellectual Yiro, something for which you need certain wisdom, a certain understanding, a certain analysis, in order to feel the Yiro which is being referred to here. In other words, I'm suggesting that there is some step in between primitive fear of the Ribbono Shel Olam and sophisticated Yerushalayim, which is being discussed over here. This is sophisticated Yerushalayim. That just so that the fires of us. This isn't a simple fear. And it's this Yerushalayim which leads to everything else. So if we can get that, that's all we need to get. Once we've got that, everything else will flow. But we see from experience that this doesn't come from automatically being scared of the Ribbono Shel Olam. There's a blockage somewhere. On the one hand, we're all able to feel scared of the Ribbono Shel Olam at times, and yet it doesn't lead on to everything else. Everything doesn't flow from there. It's not so simple. There's something wrong. Let's try and analyze what it is. That's the first area of disturbance. Why do we find things so hard? And really, they should be so terribly simple. There's another worrying development, which is a social phenomenon, or a sociological phenomenon, which is even more disturbing. And we're going to answer these two disturbances, these two worries, with the same yesod. If one tries in an oversimplified way to figure out what's gone wrong, because things have gone wrong in the world isn't what it used to be. I'm sure that's a phrase that our parents used to use and our grandparents used to use as well. But in their times, the differences were differences of degree. We're looking at differences of quality, of total shake-ups. We haven't yet recovered from the shake-up of the 1960s. In fact, we're only beginning to feel the effect of the shake-up of the 1960s. It's only now beginning to affect us. Because in 1960, it was kids who were shaking the world up. So it didn't really affect anybody. Adults went about their life more or less undisturbed. And there was a phenomenon called hippies. There was a baby boom, so there were lots and lots of these teenagers running around, and they all went batty at the same time. So you had a big group of batty teenagers doing all sorts of crazy things. But it didn't shake the world up that much, despite everything they thought. Now they're shaking the world up. Because now those batty teenagers are young couples, professionals, parents, raising another generation of children. These are the people that in America are called the anthropophobes, which is a group that makes up more than 60% of the American population. And America, as we know today, molds the thinking to a large degree of most of the Western world, certainly of the English-speaking world. So we have a situation where the world, the English-speaking world, the Western world, is today being influenced very, very heavily by those people who in 1960 were running around with long hair and bare feet on the beaches. Those are the people who are making decisions today which are directing the whole of society. The journalists, by the way, who write about Israel and about South Africa and other places all over the world are those kids. That's who they are. The young editors, the actual writers, the reporters, the photographers, all that group of people. In business, they are the people today running the business world. In the professions, these are the rising stars in the professions. So we're really only being shaken up today by what happened in the 1960s. And what happened in the 1960s didn't start in 1960. Those were kids that were brought up in the 1950s. That started already in the early 1950s. They had parents, they were being raised as children by parents in the 1950s, using the theories of Dr. Spock and where he's from. And so our problem really starts in the 1950s. In fact, the problem starts with the end of the Second World War. That's when the world got shaken up in a way that we're only now beginning to feel the effects of. What's the big shaker? That's what I've been trying to analyze. What is it that's changed so dramatically? One could go on speaking for hours and we don't have time. One sees it manifesting itself in many different areas. Firstly, in the olden days, if the world really thought that South Africa was doing a terrible thing, it was immoral and dangerous, destabilizing, the world would have gathered its forces and would have invaded South Africa. That's what it would have done. And the thing would have been over in a relatively short period of time. South Africans would have been killed in the process. Americans would have been killed in the process. There would have been a fair amount of destruction, and the thing would have been settled. Today that doesn't happen. Today warfare is declared, but it's declared in a way which doesn't cost the aggressor any lives. Doesn't have to send an army. So he imposes sanctions. But he's very careful in what area he imposes sanctions. He imposes sanctions in those areas where he's been dying for an excuse for years to disallow imports because it's damaging American trade. Textiles and steel and coal and things like that. Those areas where sacrifices would have to be made in order to impose sanctions, they don't impose sanctions. So they've developed a system of warfare which enables the aggressor to vanquish the enemy without sacrificing the soul in the process. Why? That's not the only example. The generalism is also Rosh Hashanah is a form of murder. One can kill a nation. There are interesting studies as to the effect that the journalists had on the fall of the Shah in Iran and many other such revolutions which have taken over throughout the world. There's no question that just as individuals can be annihilated by Rosh Hashanah, so can nations. And it also doesn't require the loss of the soul in the process. Well, that's why Rosh Hashanah is so evil. You're able to destroy without sticking your neck out. That's the beauty of Rosh Hashanah, that's why it's so powerful. You don't have anything to lose. If you want to go and challenge a person to a duel, you might be the loser. So that we're not prepared to do. But Rosh Hashanah you can't lose. Only the other person can lose, so you think. All this is not just by chance, all this is because the view is in America today, and in most Western countries, that without compulsory military service, the Americans would be unable today to mobilize an army to go into overseas territory. Nobody would be willing to fight. And that's what that, thank you very much, I've got my own life to live. I'm not going to sacrifice my life for some war in some distant country. One of the disturbing things is that it's happening in Israel today as well. But a large reason for the mass emigration is army service. Not prepared to do it. Or one more, two or three wars, it's been enough. I'm not prepared to sacrifice my life or the lives of my children. That wasn't the atmosphere that existed before the Second World War. It wasn't the atmosphere that existed before the First World War. But it's symptomatic of a breakdown in society, which we're going to try and analyze. Families break down, societies break down, communities break down. Why? Shtetlach in Europe didn't used to break down. Even when there was Machlokes and Faribul, they didn't used to break down. People used to put it together again. Not today. Communities today get destroyed. Previously they didn't get destroyed. What is it that binds people together and what is it that draws them asunder? what draws people asunder, what drives them apart more than anything else, is when they are driven by a sense of entitlement. Because two people's entitlements are on collision course. The moment two people are obsessed with their own entitlements, there must be friction between them, because they're competing with one another for limited resources. If an employer is only aware of his entitlements, his rights, and an employee is only aware of his rights, nothing can work. What is it that brings people together? Sense of duty. If an employer is aware of his sense of duty to his employee, and the employee is imbued with a sense of duty to his employer, then you've got a bonded unit which cannot be broken by anything external. The employer says, you know, you haven't taken a holiday for 2 years, it's time for you to take a holiday. And the employee says, a holiday, we're in this kind of situation where we can't afford to hire any extra person, and whatever can be done is productive. You know, are you crazy talking about taking a holiday? What's wrong with you? What kind of a manager are you? And they have an argument about that. Such an organization can only succeed, because nothing can pull it apart. If the husband is only aware of his duties to his wife, and the wife is only aware of her duties to her husband, it must bound together, it must be strong, it must be powerful. There's nothing that can pull such a marriage apart. So the sense of duty is more than anything that which is gone. I don't have a duty to my country. I have a duty to myself. And I'm not going to sacrifice my life or put it into danger to fight for my country, to fight for my society. It's not worth it. Where did all this come from? The chiddush of the hippie generation was the glorification of the value of voluntary action and the despising of anything compulsive. That was their chiddush. But what you do spontaneously because you want it, that's the highest value. If you're doing it because somebody told you to do it, if you're doing it because you feel you have to do it out of a sense of duty and obligation, that's nothing. What are you, a slave? An independent person does what he wants. That was what the hippie generation taught. That's what the hippie generation practiced. And that's what, little by little, they swayed the entire Western world to accept. And so compulsory military service went out of fashion in one country after another, and was replaced by voluntary military service. And so in all sorts of areas, compulsion was replaced by volition. How does one imbue a person with a sense of duty? This is something that in the Beis HaMikdash we've been speaking about for weeks already, with virtually no effect. This is what's led me to try and analyze a little. Virtually no effect. Hasn't made any impact at all. There is such a thing as a duty. There is such a thing as being at a certain place at a certain time because I have to. I owe it. We've spoken about it, and it's had little impact. Why? What's lacking? What is it in society, Jewish and non-Jewish, frum and non-frum, national, social, communal, family? What is it that has caused us to lose the sense of duty, and how does one develop the sense of duty? So Medrash talks about one of the Amirim, I forget who he was, who had a terrible time with his wife. She really used to cause him great suffering. It happens. The marriage was two great people, two outstanding people, otherwise he would never have married her in the first place. It didn't work. The marriage was exceptionally unhappy. And his Talmidim felt a certain resentment towards her for what she did, the way she humiliated him and pressurized him. And yet wherever he went, when he was away from home, if he saw anything nice and attractive, he would buy it and lovingly wrap it up for her and take it to her. One day the students couldn't restrain themselves, and they said to him, Rebbe, isn't it enough that she disturbs your life to this extent? So that you haven't divorced her is already a chiddush. You have to take her gifts for it. What kind of thing is this? He answered, "Dayos shemegadlos es penechonenu, matzilos es sulman en achi." It's sufficient that they raise our children and they save us from sin. That through my wife I am able to elevate a primitive human drive into one of the greatest mitzvahs that there are. How can I repay a person for that? That something which would otherwise be wild and undisciplined and meaningless, she's the one who makes it meaningful. She's the one who gives it substance. Raising my children would be impossible without her. She's making a good job of it. How can I possibly pay anybody, any human being, for such a thing? What do we have here? A sense of duty. An understanding that irrespective of the service I have from her, that doesn't cancel out the debt of gratitude that I owe her. It has no effect on it. Because there's no way I can measure and quantify that debt of gratitude, as we discussed on Tuesday night in matters of Kibbutz Arba'im. You can't give a value to it. You can't say, well, she deserved me for 3 days, that's worth 1 day of not looking after my children. I hope she doesn't get a thank you for that day. You can't work like that. What she's done, if she would do nothing but that, if that's all she's worth, there's no way that I can repay such a debt of gratitude. That's a sense of duty. That's the kind of thing which the hippies of the 1960s would have mocked at as ridiculous, clinging to old-fashioned values and forms just because you're afraid of the stigma of divorce. That's how they would have turned it. Chazal turned it. Nothing I can do. I owe her a debt of gratitude. I'm stuck with her. Can't do anything with her. I'm stuck with her in a loving way, and in a way that is demonstrative of that debt of gratitude. Now, my wife told me a story last night of a young couple that he was involved with in his town in the Shrove, the Mission of Zion. The young couple were living together, unmarried, completely irreligious. And all of a sudden he decided he wants to become religious. With his brother's bar mitzvah, started really young with him. Somebody saw him one day and said, "You call that religious? Put on the yarmulke and you think you're religious? You're still living with your girlfriend? What kind of business is this? If you want to be religious, you have to see Rabbi Walker." Which he did. Over a period of time he became more and more involved. It was a long story. The girl rebelled. She didn't like this business that her boyfriend was becoming more involved until she saw the threat of another girlfriend on the horizon, and then she too started becoming involved. But not as much as he. She little by little things, slowly, but he was really learning, and eventually went to a yeshiva in Bnei Brak. By this time, of course, they were not living together. His Rosh Yeshiva phones Rabbi Walpi and says, "You know, I'm very disturbed that you're still encouraging this young man to marry this young lady. Don't you realize how far this young man has come in Yiddishkeit? How firm he is? He's learning in yeshiva. Where is she holding? She's hardly keeping shots. What kind of yeshiva is this?" Which Rabbi Walpi very correctly answered very forcefully, "If I was suggesting a new shidduch, you would have a tanya. What kind of shidduch are you suggesting? But does it mean nothing to you that they've been living together for years already? That he's wrecked her life? What he owes her? Where's the manshlichkeit? So because he's become more firm than her, he must now drop her, and all the years that he took away from her, he must now leave her to sort out for herself? Is that the manshlichkeit? Is that what the Torah teaches?" People don't think that way. With a sense of duty. "Sorry, I'm stuck with her. That's my duty. How am I going to sort it out? That's my problem. How I sort it out. But to drop her, that I can't do. I have an obligation." That's old-fashioned. It's old-fashioned in the secular world, old-fashioned in the non-Jewish world, and it's old-fashioned in the Torah world too. The sense that there is an overriding sense of obligation sometimes, which has to be followed through. The end of the story, by the way, is that she's a nice Jewish lady today, there's a shekel, and they're happily married. The sense of duty occurs when an independent minded person receives a contribution. That's when a sense of duty is conceived. When an independent minded person receives a contribution. Now that's a principle that exists, as we discussed in the Vilna Gaon Shiur last Shabbos. Principles of nature apply in the spiritual world as well. The Ribbono Shel Olam created the world with the same principles in all the different disciplines. The physical principles, the economic principles, the social principles, the religious principles, it's all the same principles. They work in different sets, they work in different backgrounds, but the principle works the same. And in business, this would appear to be an obvious concept. That if an individual receives a contribution, it creates an obligation. He's got to pay back. Now the truth is everybody is independent minded. But we handle our desire for independence in two different ways. Until very recently, in the business world, there was only one way to handle a sense of indebtedness, and that was to repay. That principle became old-fashioned in 1973, when the Arabs taught the world that that was no longer a necessary concept in the business world. If you're indebted, and you don't feel like paying, you don't pay. That's all. Particularly if you've got a product which the world can't manage without. The reason the Arabs could get away from that is because the world was already beginning to be influenced by hippies. They were already a major voting power. Because if hippies weren't a major voting power, the Western world would have taken over the oil fields. That's what would have happened. You don't pay your debts, we take you over. The same in the business world. You can't pay, we take you over. And that's the way business and politics has been running for thousands of years. Country can't pay its debt, you become slaves. We take you over. But since the Arabs were clever enough to know that no country would go to war over oil, because the young people were not willing to allow them or their children to go to war over oil, they realized they could hit at the soft underbelly of the Western world, and there's nothing at all that the world would do about it. Not nothing they could do about it, they could do plenty. There's nothing they would do about it. And so the lack of moral character, which commenced in the early 1960s, or as we've said, in the early 1950s already, enabled the Arabs to teach the world that contracts don't mean anything. And that principle became accepted worldwide. If a business gets into severe debt, paying the debt is the last thing they think of. It's just a question of how do you go bankrupt in the most honorable way. That's all. How do you get out of it? Not how do you repay, how do you get out of it? The concept that you have to pay, that's the only way out, is old-fashioned. Still got a few individual, older business people who think that's where, but it's rare. The normal belief is one finds a way out. Because, as we said, there are two ways of handling independence. And I look at my balance sheet every year and I see that I owe a creditor a lot of money, I can either repay it, but that requires sacrifice, or I could get rid of that debit entry somehow by going bankrupt, opening another company, all sorts of things, anything, just to get rid of it. But to live with it, I can't. A sense of duty is created when an independent minded person receives a contribution, and the only way he can now get rid of that feeling of dependence. Because Eved Loivel Ishmalvin, an independent minded person accepts and understands that if I owe anybody money, I am dependent on him, I'm an Eved, I'm a slave to him. If the bank manager phones and I've got an overdraft there, I jump. Because I'm an Eved. That's what it means to owe money. The only way to retain my freedom is to repay the debt. The other kind of person will figure out some other drag of getting rid of the debt without repaying it. The Tzara Shoveh, the common denominator, is none of us like to live with debt. The difference is how we choose to handle our indebtedness. When children grow up, in a family that stresses entitlement, it never enters their mind that the way to repay indebtedness is to repay the debt. Never enters their mind. All I've got to look at, if I've been raised with a high sense of entitlement, all I've got to analyze is, my goodness, I'm a slave. I'm entitled to be a free man. Why am I a slave? Because I look in my books and I see I owe money. I've got to get rid of that debt. It's not that I owe money, it's I have a debt which needs to be gotten rid of some way or other. And if in the process of getting rid of it, other people suffer, that's business. What can you do? I'm entitled to my independence. I'm entitled to be free of that indebtedness. That's not the case in a family where an individual is raised with a sense of duty. Where he's raised with a sense of duty, he doesn't look at his balance sheet and say, my goodness, I am heavy. He looks at his balance sheet and says, my goodness, my creditor still hasn't been paid. He's out of pocket. How can I live like this? How can I live with myself? That's how he operates. And he realizes there's only one way out of it. Slowly, slowly, he's got to pay off that creditor. Until he's done that, he remains a slave. That's the old-fashioned way. Let's go back to our subject of Yiro. This subject of duties, entitlements, is a long discussion. Yiro, we said, last time we discussed it, was that basic primitive fear. I'm scared of consequences, the same as I'm scared to put my finger into the electric plug because I know what will happen. So I'm scared to anger the Ribbono Shel Olam because I know what will happen. And what's been worrying us is, why doesn't that work? In theory, we're all scared of the Ribbono Shel Olam. We all know that he's a God, otherwise we wouldn't be sitting here this evening. We know that there are consequences, we know that he judges. We're worried, we come to Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, we get quite shaky. So we're scared. Why can't we do anything with that fear? Why can't we utilize that fear and span it in to drive us to greater heights? Why do we stay as we are? The answer is, it's not so simple, this fear business. Unless I acknowledge that I'm bankrupt, there's nothing to be scared of. If I don't know that my account is indebted, I'm not scared of the bank manager. What can he do to me? To have a little bit of accounting knowledge to know that I'm bankrupt, in order to have the correct fear of what's credited. But a person who has a high sense of entitlement and to whom it never enters his mind that debts are there to be repaid, debts are there to be gotten rid of ultimately, or to live with as long as one can. And the whole world operates like that now. Everybody knows that the third world is never going to repay their debts. They can't. Everybody knows that the South American countries are never going to repay their debts. They can't. Goes on and on and on, never, never, debts aren't there to be repaid somehow, nobody expects it. And that breeds a certain moral system into our society. And we don't expect debtors to pay up. It's not expected by the creditors, they know it can't be. And so should they be worried? What do they have to be worried about? People often comment that it's easier if one's indebted really to the bank for millions of rand, one has a far better relationship with the bank than if you have a 50 rand overdraft. If you have a 50 rand overdraft, the bank manager is phoning you every day, what's with your account, what's with your account. If you've got a 10 million rand overdraft, it's a different story. He's very nervy. And he's just happy to see you going along nicely. You'll be paid, look. We'll worry about that some other day. As long as you're alive, there's a chance of him being repaid. The moment you're dead, there's no chance of him being repaid. And he's more nervous than you are. And that also breeds a certain atmosphere of being able to live with it without shame and without disgrace. If we don't feel that we're indebted with the Ribbono Shel Olam, where does the era start? If we feel that we're entitled to his love and we're entitled to his caring and we're entitled to life and we're entitled to good fortune, what's there to be scared of? What can he do to us if we're entitled to it? He knows we're entitled to it. And the fact is, we do believe we're entitled to it. Because you never hear, never, very, very seldom do you hear a person coming. I hear a person coming saying, Rabbi, I need to speak to you. I have a problem. Things are going very well with me, Baruch Hashem. And I have a major theological problem. I don't know why. I don't deserve it. whatever I do is wrong. Is there no redemption in the world? Is there no justice in the world? I can't understand it. Never happens. But you can't imagine how many times there was a Torah. Why me? Look what I do, and I do this, and I do that. Why me? That shows the sense of entitlement that we have. We take it absolutely for granted. Every day that we get through, which goes through in peace and in good health, we assume is due to us. Let the Ribbono Shel Olam just turn the screws on once, and we start wondering, well, what's going on here? What's he doing? What's it all about? Why me? As long as we live with a high sense of entitlement, like the African countries and the South American countries, nothing to be scared of. The Ribbono Shel Olam accredited it. Either we're so bankrupt that the emotion just wants to see us stay alive, like the bank manager has owed millions of rands, or we believe we're not bankrupt at all. We believe we're entitled to it. So how do you? This becomes a very important element in education. It becomes an important element in the education of children. It also becomes an important element in Torah education. We've discussed this before, but not in this particular angle. In days gone by, it used to be very difficult to get into a yeshiva. And when a child got into a yeshiva, when a boy got into a yeshiva, he knew he was there at the expense of somebody else. Because there were far more applicants than there were seats. And he felt a sense of obligation. He had to live up to it. He felt a sense of responsibility. He felt a sense of privilege. He certainly didn't feel a sense of entitlement. In those days, money making was a very, very small part of the yeshiva's existence. The yeshiva operated in the most terrible straits of poverty. The boys had very little to eat. The living conditions were meager. Their clothing was very little. Countless stories of the conditions under which young men used to learn Torah in the pre-Second World War era. And always before that. This is the first time, virtually in history, that a young boy can go to a yeshiva and he has a bedroom far nicer than anything he's got at home. And his meals are far better than anything he's used to at home. And if once it happens that the food's not quite up to standard, there are already complaints to the Anhola that the food's no good. This is a very new phenomenon in the yeshiva world. And the yeshivas have become major fundraising institutions. They have to keep up with the service. Many of them do. And it becomes a bit of a vicious circle sometimes, where in order to keep the boys, you need to raise the money to keep the standard of living reasonable. And in order to justify the fundraising machinery, one has to see that there are enough boys, otherwise you can't exactly go around raising money and say, I've got half a dozen boys, no, it's an issue. And so the yeshiva needs to get bigger. And if the yeshiva gets bigger, you need more money. If you need more money, you need still more Talmidim. And so the institutions have a dynamicism of their own, and probably we're very fortunate, Baruch Hashem, that it is so, because otherwise they might not have grown at the pace that they have. We don't have enough L'shem Shemayim today for young men in the numbers that they are learning today to dedicate themselves to Torah if it was in the conditions that existed 50 years ago, 60 years or 70 years ago. So things are different, things operate differently. But one thing that in the process is created is a sense of entitlement among the young boys. There's almost a competing for their allegiance. There's a need, a feeling among the young boys sometimes that is needed. And whether that's true or not, in education that's negative. Because the feeling of bankruptcy doesn't exist. My bank manager needs me. And the moment that exists, the feeling of duty disappears and the feeling of responsibility disappears. But Yisrael Salanta said that nobody should open an institution unless he knows how to close it. That wasn't just because maybe one day he'll have to close it. Truth is, very seldom has any great institution had to be closed. And when it has, it's been for not for reasons of not enough money or not enough talmidim, but virtually never happened. So what did he mean? That anybody who opens an institution must know how to close it. That knowledge, that willingness and ability to close it has to exist at all times of the operation of the institution. For if at any stage a Talmud will feel that the Rosh Yeshiva is not willing to close the institution, then he becomes an important factor in the existence of the institution, and there's a sense of entitlement rather than a sense of duty. It's not my duty as a Talmud to ensure that this institution continues. It will continue in any case. His ambitions want it to continue. And on the contrary, he needs me to make it continue. And then there's no feeling of duty, there's no feeling of obligation, there's no feeling of benefit. The flow is from the Talmud to the Rebbe, not from the Rebbe to the Talmud. It's from the Talmud to the Yeshiva, not from the Yeshiva to the Talmud. That's something which we've tried very hard to avoid ever occurring in the Beis Hamikdash. It's for that reason that while I do try and put a fair amount of pressure on people, once they've decided to be part of the Beis Hamikdash, to keep to the sidonim of the Beis Hamikdash, to partake in shiurim, to develop themselves in learning, to attend the davening, that yes, a sense of duty. But the decision whether or not to be part of it, that I'm not willing to interfere. If there are people who want to be part of it, there will be an institution. If there are not people who want to be a part of it, there will not be an institution. That's all. But that there should never be a feeling that the people are yetzer by being there, they're already yetzer. By signing membership forms and such, if such things exist, but they've done their duty already. Well, that ensures the continuity of the place. Now they've done their duty, now they're members, now they're entitled to the benefits of membership. That's the way the world thinks today. Once I've signed, I'm entitled to the benefits of membership. That's not the way we think. We think the benefits of membership are the sense of duty which it entails. And if those that sense of duty is too much for me, then I can't give it myself to. A man whose sense of duty to his marriage is too big for him should not get married. A person whose sense of duty to his family is too great for him should not have a family. A person whose sense of duty to his business or to his profession is too great for him to carry should not get involved in it. And so it is. A person whose sense of duty is too onerous upon him in joining a yeshiva or a Beis Hamikdash or a society or a community or becoming a citizen of a country should not do so either. I mentioned in previous talks during the last week elsewhere that in the whole immigration drama, I'm not getting involved again in the topic of whether yes or whether not. What's interesting though is the process of thinking that people go through and what is omitted from that process of thinking. The future of the children, the business future, the future of the adults, the safety of the family. I have got aging parents here, sometimes in an old age home, sometimes living on their own. Again, I'm not commenting on what has to decide and how one has to decide in such a situation. Each individual is a different story. But not even entering the mind as a duty which might be relevant to the decision as to whether one is entitled to emigrate. I have a duty. I would love to go, I feel insecure here, I've got a professional opportunity, all sorts of things. That's I want, but what about I have to? I have parents to look after. Is that not a consideration in the whole way now? And the other is, again, I'm not commenting on what weight such a consideration has to have, but it must be a consideration. Do I perhaps not have a duty to the country as well? The society from which I benefited. I got my schooling there. I got my university there. My parents made their money there. I lived happily there. Do I have a duty or don't I have a duty? Just think about it. I'm not talking about what the answer to that question is. But maybe I have a duty to that society to put something back into it, not just to take from it. That sense of duty doesn't exist. If I come to the conclusion that it's in the best interest of my family to go, that's all that matters. If I have a duty to my family, it doesn't matter. To my wider family, to my parents. If I have a duty to my country, to my society, that doesn't matter. The only thing is with myself. We sometimes do things because we want to. And we're even intelligent enough to do things because they're expedient. Because we expect certain benefits from doing them. But neither of those motivations are true measures of a human being's greatness. to do that which you want to do. I used to have a dog, and he was able to do exactly what he wanted. A fine dog, and a human being who's able to do what he wants to, is also a fine dog. A dog is not yet quite ready to be expedient, to figure out, I don't want to, it's quite uncomfortable to do it in fact, but it's to my long-term benefit, that the dog can't do. But I said, really, you need a bit of safer. Maybe certain Baalei Chaim can do it, I don't know. But already you've got to be a little bit of a, you've got to have a human mind to be able to do that, to be able to calculate. That's expediency. But that still is not an expression of a great human being. That's simply an expression of an expedient human being, a selfish human being. The measure of greatness is a human being who's saying, I don't want to, and there's nothing in it for me. What can I do? I have to. That's it. There's just no question I've got to do it. We don't even come to the question of whether I want to or not, because it's totally irrelevant. I have to. I have no choice. And the hippies of the 1960s would say, you have no choice, then what's the greatness, what's the chup of doing it? The chup is to free choice, do what you choose to do, not what you have to do. We say no. To do what you choose to do, an animal can do. To do what you have to do, only a human being can do. And only a moral human being can do. And so it is when it comes to social and communal obligations within a structure such as a basic English. I want to learn Chavrusa with somebody, that's one consideration. It's to my benefit to learn Chavrusa with somebody, that's another consideration. That I have an obligation. I have an obligation to help somebody else out. I have an obligation to contribute, to give, to add, to be productive. That's a different category altogether. I feel like coming to davening this morning because I'm awake in any case. Or I enjoy it, or whatever, it's very nice. But that's not the same as I'm dead tired, I don't feel like going, I can daven at home, or in a later meeting somewhere else. I have an obligation. When one's building a community, the question of where one davens, geographical proximity is only a consideration for people who are ill. I'm not talking about geographical proximity in the sense of miles and miles away. That one doesn't go to the nearest place, one goes to the place that one's involved. Same as when it comes to shopping, one doesn't go to the nearest shop, you go to the shop where you get the best credit terms, where you know the prices are cheapest, you choose where you go. And where you feel a sense of obligation. I have a friend who's opened a business and he's 2 miles down the road, that's where I go. Want to go, don't want to go, I have to go. That's just my loyalty to my friend, there's no question about that. Family has a simcha, or never has a tzorah. The community has to rally around. It's not a question of what kind of relationship do I have with him, do I like him, don't I like him, am I friendly with him, am I not friendly with him. Well, the community, one has to, there's no choice. It's part of the sense of duty. How does one build a society? How does one build a community if there's not that overriding sense of obligation and sense of duty? Of course, there are sometimes conflicting senses of duties, and one has to sort them out. That's what one needs the Torah for. One has a duty to a family, and one has a duty to a community. They conflict. I have a duty to a family and a duty to a country. They conflict. All these things have to be sorted out halachically. That's where halacha comes in. But for somebody who's not even cognizant of his duties, he has no shyness. He doesn't even open the Shulchan Aruch. Because he just does what he wants in any case. A Shulchan Aruch is only applicable to a person who has an overriding sense of duty and on occasion finds these duties in conflict and has to consult a Shulchan Aruch as to how to resolve the conflict. But there has to be first that sense of duty. V'yata Yisroel ma'ashem elekecho shoyim meimoch. What does the Ribbono Shel'olam want from you? Ki im liyiros Hashem elekecho. To be afraid of the Ribbono Shel'olam. And here we had a difficulty that this means the higher level of Yirah can't be, because that's covered in last week's Sefer. So what does this mean? It's the lower level of Yirah. It means fear. And yet the Chodesh HaZadah says the seat of this fear is in the mind, in the thought, a rave of a riot of a machshava. So what kind of fear is it? It's the fear of the bank manager. That's all. It's the knowledge that I'm bankrupt. But that needs analysis. That needs self-analysis. It's the knowledge I owe this world more than I'm giving it. I owe the Ribbono Shel Olam more than I'm giving him. And in fact, by the looks of it, I owe him more than I'm ever going to be able to give him. that makes one lie awake at night, if one is an independent-minded person. If one understands the sense of indebtedness that creates, then one understands that one is in a state of worry, of fear. Then it becomes simple fear again, then it's animal fear. But whereas an animal has his fears instinctively, a human being sometimes has to use his mind just to perceive that there is a cause of fear, there's something to be scared about. And without that ability to analyze one's figures and read the balance sheet and see there's cause to be fear, to be fearful, without that ability there is no fear, there's nothing to be scared. One can blissfully continue in one's ignorant ways and believe that everything's okay. In conclusion, Rehoboth HaVavos says in the beginning of the Shaira, Avas Hashem, Ve'i efshar sheyagia ha'odom ileho, Elo acha she'tiklon yir'osoy fachadom eloki yisbarach. It is not possible for a man to reach Ahava, to reach love of God, unless it has been preceded by yir'osoy ufachadoy, his yiro and his pachad. And this phrase has always worried me. Yiro, pachad. When we to translate pachad as the primitive fear and yiro as the greater fear, then firstly it should be the other way around, that it should be shetikdam pachadoy the yiro, so first the primitive fear, pachad, scared him, the yiro, so and holding him in awe. The order is wrong. Secondly, it appears from most Rishonim that the greater levels of Yiro come only after Ahava. So you first have the basic Yiro, and then you have Ahava, and then you have the higher levels of Yiro. And here the Chodesh Avodah says there must be Yiro Soyu Fachado, so we see there are two elements in the basic Yiro which must precede Ahava. What are these two elements? First, Yiro. Yiro is that fear which is already defined as being, in the seat of which is the mind and the thought and the intellect. That fear which results from an acknowledgement and an understanding that my balance sheet shows I'm bankrupt. And the consequence, pachad. Then I can get to pachad. So whereas last year when we discussed this, we said first level was animal fear. And from there everything else comes. And now a year later I look around at myself and everybody around me and I see that's not true. With all the animal fear in the world, nothing happens. And one wonders why not? What goes wrong? You see, we've missed the point. There's something that becomes comes before the animal fear. Because an animal knows intuitively what to be scared of. A human being has to analyze his books before he knows whether there's anything to be scared of or not. As long as he thinks he's liquid, there's nothing to be scared of. Because he doesn't know it. And so here it comes first. The intellectual analysis of one's state of affairs comes first. Then there's pachad, then there's animal fear. My goodness, I'm bankrupt. The devotion can call in the overdraft any day, any minute, any moment. He can say, look here, what's going on? Giving you a chance, each day it's just getting worse. Then there's pachad. That will then motivate one to move further. Lech is b'chol d'rochov. And say, I'm bankrupt and there's a balabos somewhere. Let's do what he wants me to do. Then he go to the bank manager and say, you know, I'm bankrupt. What do you suggest I do? I'll follow your instructions. With Ahava Yisrael, and to love him. Love is not a motivator for the mitzvahs, as the hippies of the 1960s thought. Love is a consequence of the mitzvahs. One can love a person to whom one feels one is doing one's duty. When one feels one is not doing one's duty, one can't love them, one feels too guilty. This is one of the problems one finds in marriage and in parent-child relationships. There cannot be love when there's guilt. And there's always guilt when a duty is not being performed. That's why you find so many of the immigrants become bitter about this country. It's very often, if a person has thought it through and felt, I've done the right thing, he doesn't become bitter. He looks back with love and with respect and with gratitude. Might be critical, but not bitter. But when a person has gone without thinking it through, constantly worried consciously and subconsciously that he hasn't fulfilled his duties, there can be no love. On the contrary, that love that should be there is slowly replaced by bitterness and by hatred. Once you realize you're bankrupt and you start going in the ways of the Ribbono Shel Olam, then the arrows, then you can stop loving him. Now that one feels one is doing one's duty to the best of one's ability, an ahava can develop, a love can develop. And then you can reach the Mesilus Nefesh. Then you can reach the levels where you're prepared to give your life for something that you love. So whereas the hippies thought, first love, then do out of love and out of your own desire and your own volition, volunteer, and that's the highest level there can be. The Torah teaches the opposite. First define your duty, then act. And then you know what? All of a sudden you found you're loving, without even knowing how it came about and how it happened. Young people who fall in love before they're married, there's something wrong. Either they've been doing too much of their duty, or they're not really in love. Love can only come when one feels that a duty is being fulfilled, that I'm giving the other party to the best, everything that they're deserving of to the best of my ability. Then love can develop. That's the root which the Torah lays out for us. And just as it lays it out for us in Ben Adam and Mokrim, the way we handle with the Ribbono Shel Olam, so the same root exactly applies in our business lives, in our interpersonal lives, in our communal lives. The more one puts in, the more love there develops. Those who have a sense of entitlement and wait for the love to come before they put in, I'll put in as long as I feel the love. The love will never come and the contribution will never come. Those who make the contribution will develop the love will come afterwards. And hopefully with that understanding, it is possible for a life to change. It is possible for the direction of a life to change. It's possible for the stature of an individual to change overnight with the understanding of this principle. For the quality of a family to change, for the quality of a community to change. This is the understanding. First define my duties, then act, then love. Then one has a bond among people which cannot be broken, which cannot be interfered with, because it's governed by something bigger than our own desires, bigger than our own sense of expediency, governed by the feeling that we have a debt to pay, governed by a feeling that we have received more than we have contributed, and by our unending desire to bring the books back into balance by constantly increasing the contributions we make to the Ribbono Shel Olam and to one another, not only in quantity but also in quality.